I'm just trying to make sure this is on. Okay. Who is my timer tonight? Anyone? Can you hear me now? Okay. Yes.
Are the timing sheets on there?
Yes, they are. Okay. Sorry.
We're missing 10 minutes.
Yes, I'm just trying to reorganize here. Nope. Oh, thank you. How to be good at five.
You know what? Whoever's doing the timing will hold up 10 fingers.
That sounds like a good plan.
Did you want this up?
Sure. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to take it away. So I've got pictures that Cindy will pass around if you haven't seen them, if you've already seen them, or else she's sent them out, you know, feel free. So last night I talked about where I was. It's kind of like my food log. And now today I'm going to talk about my walk back into recovery. So just recap, I was in OA from 85 to about 1990, and gave away my program due to my people-pleasing and slippery slope of not being diligent in my program. So when I was at my height of restricting, I got down to 120 pounds, and oh, I forgot to say too, for 6 months I stopped getting my period because I was so obsessed with making sure I had low fat. And then I got together with people in my program and so on, and started working a healthier program for the last, you know, probably year number four. And then year number five is when I met my guy and gave it all away. And then I walked into full-fledged relapse for 14 years. And basically, I was holding my own at about 150, and I'm just going to bring up my weight and so on, just so you can see the different phases and whatever. And then started eating my way up to 260 pounds. That's the highest I know from when I weighed. And I tried all kinds of diets. I even tried giving up certain food groups, like all dairy. I gave up Diet Colas because I was addicted to that and did that for a while. And of course, as I said, you know, I smoked because I was going to keep that weight off. Well, I smoked just fine at 260, just as I did when I was younger and a teenager. So, yeah, 120 was always like my ideal weight, and then it was 150, and then it became 260, and then I just didn't care after that because I just knew I was fat. And basically what I wore were big sloppy t-shirts that you saw. They came in many colors, you know, black, purple, blue, red, and black stretchy pants because I needed to move and grow, and then I didn't have to see, you know, am I gaining weight or not, and that type of thing. And I started wearing more mannish clothes, and not to say that wearing more mannish clothes is wrong or bad, it was just that I'm just going to be badass, and I'm going to make sure that people keep their distance. And I not only was it, I wore it. And so that was my life, and I was angry. As I said, in my family, it was okay to be angry. And so when people say I have an anger problem, I'd say I have absolutely do not. I show anger very, very well. It was a big deal for me to cry. That was weakness. That was being a total wimp. I'm the oldest of five, too. I think I was raised as half man, half woman. And there's times I can just tell. I'm just a very strong woman, and sometimes go too much to one side and, you know, need to learn some other things on the other, and that's where this program helps. Excuse me. So right before coming back to OA, I decided I was thinking I was going to do another pay-in way, and I really hesitated because I thought, well, I could do this online, and I already know that wasn't going to happen because, you know, you can sit there and work the computer with one hand and stuff your face with the other. I've done that very well. And I did stop smoking in 2004, I did it backwards, you know. There was a time before I joined the program, then I quit smoking. So I know I'm addicted to smoking as well. Anyway, that's an outside issue. But there was a woman at work, and she was a little woman, as I know I can get. But she was all of a sudden becoming a little tame, and she was losing some weight. So I asked her one day, I said, "Hey, Sue, what are you doing?" She goes, "Well," she goes, "I found this great program. It's called OA." I said, "Oh yeah, I know all about that. I did that years ago." "Well, Meg, I think you should try it again." And I said, "I don't need that. It didn't work." So a couple times later, she'd come back and say, Meg, would you ever want to go to a meeting with me and go Sunday night, you know, such and such a place?" No, Sunday night doesn't work for me. And then, you know, she came back probably the fourth or fifth time, and finally I said, "Oh, good God." I said, "You act like you're working on commission." I said, "Not interested." But it was still enough, because meanwhile I was, beep, 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 beep to my heart or core, wherever that was, that I needed help, because I knew Painway wasn't going to do the trick. And whatever I was doing was definitely not doing the trick. And, you know, the whole bottom line in those 14 years, I was sick and tired of waking up in the middle of the night with horrid acid reflux where I couldn't breathe. And then I'd sit propped on my pillow, sucking down sugar-laced anti-acid tablets and, you know, grown-up candy, and just having pain in my knees. And I went to an orthopedic doctor, and basically, I know he would have liked to have said, but he was very kind and gentle. He would have said, "Hey, sister, why don't you take a load off, and maybe you'll save those knees." But instead, he said, "Well, I don't know if you're aware, but every extra 10 pounds you have in your knees, it's like an extra 30. Well, I didn't like hearing that. I wanted something different. You know, that was kind of boring. You know, who wants to lose weight? So anyway, rageful. Of course, you know, okay, it's everybody else's fault, for everyone else would do this. I had a horrid coworker, you know, my life. I was real famous then for underemploying myself after leaving teaching and doing all of this and getting back into the food and so on, that people didn't really understand how intelligent I really was. But you know, I'm not, you know, civil engineer or, you know, brain surgeon or whatever. But, you know, it's that whole self-esteem. It's that whole me. So I did what you couldn't do back in the 80s, is I looked up OA online. And I saw that there was a meeting pretty close to my house on Monday nights. Well, I wasn't so sure because, you know, I had to stay home and feed my face and watch reruns. So I did that one Monday night. And then I thought, you know what, this is ridiculous. Your life is horrid. You are horrid to people. You're dying. So I went, and I remember I went in with lots of love. There were six people there, and I said, "I've been to OA, I know all about the program." So I was so defensive, and you know what, they welcomed me anyway. Because I felt so defensive because I had to come back. I had to admit I was a failure. A failure in what? So anyway, but I knew this is where I needed to be. And the next week, this other woman had been on vacation because it was June 14th, 2004. And she had been on vacation and came in and shared that night, I remember, on step 9, and I knew I wanted her as my sponsor. And I just beelined for her after the meeting. I'm probably sure I knocked down a couple people as I ran for her and then tackled her on the ground. But anyway, I asked her, and graciously she said yes. And I decided then and there, I'm going to work this program so differently than I have in the past. I decided to be honest. No more, "Oh, I'm Meg, I've got it all together." No more, "I'm Meg, I'm the oldest, and I'm this, that, and the other thing." Who cares? I'm Meg. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm an addict. Period. Amen. So that's what I started doing. And one of the first lessons I learned from her, I was whining about something that someone did to me. And, you know, she just didn't understand my no and blah, 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 blah. And finally she said, "Meg, the reason she didn't understand, respect your no, is because you don't." I felt like she had punched me in the trachea. So I just stopped and I looked at her. I know what I wanted to say. And I said, "You know, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right." And I think that was a turning point that I think I'm going to get it this time. I think I'm going to go all in and not worry about the vain and glory of if I lose weight. So I'll just tell a bit about my food plan back then. It's 3 meals a day. I eat basic American food, go to restaurants and just eat one serving and that's it. Gave all my sugar up. I knew that was, And I remembered way in the back of my mind what it was like to be abstinent in the sense that I knew I was going to feel hungry at first and I knew I was going to go through like toxic shock syndrome because, you know, your skin's going to ooze it, you know, your skin's going to smell, your digestive system's going to be like, woohoo, and release and whatever. I mean, that's, you know, that's all the stuff, you know, we don't really want to talk about, but it's the real deal. And so I just really worked on that. And the weight just started falling off. And I thought, all right, I'm not going to worry about it. I hadn't weighed for years. I thought, I'm not going to start now. Why should I do that? Because I got obsessed about it. Back when I was in restrictor, I'd weigh myself 20 times a day. Right after I go to the bathroom, right after I exhaled, right after, because it might be different. You know, my breath's very heavy. I don't know about yours. But anyway, that's what I did. And I went to meetings, and I decided to take the key so I'd open up the door every week so I would be there. That stuff like that works for me, because then if I didn't show up, and I was the only one holding the key, I would have to somehow slink somewhere, and I didn't have phone numbers at the time, because, you know, I was just going to be direct with my sponsor. And I certainly wasn't going to call her and say, well, I'm not doing this anymore or whatever. So it was a good thing. So I remember after my second year, I was having a little chat with my higher power, and I was like, oh, I don't feel like going tonight. I go to a lot of meetings. One meeting a week. And my higher power said, you know what, Meg? You don't have to. You can have that life you used to have. I got my car, put the keys in, boom, I was there. There's a reason why I'm telling you that. So, started going to meetings. I started getting new jobs. And better paying jobs because there was more responsibility and better use of my skills. And what that tapped into for me was, what if I fail? What if I goof up? What if I don't know everything? It was easy to be something else that was easy for me, but to do this was hard. And yet I learned and started having more self-esteem and so on. Then I got a second job with even more money. I worked as a project manager, and I, you know, it was a hard role because I'd never been an official IT project manager before, and there's certain rules and lingo and all that, so I really had quite a learning curve. And, you know, did my best to do what I could and decided to go back to school. So I started working on my master's and, you know, doing all that. Well, meanwhile, at my job, I got a new boss. And things started shifting and getting kind of ugly pretty fast. And for a year, I put up with severe bullying in the workplace. And there were 3 women, my supervisor at the time, a director, and the vice president. And all that time, I called, I whined, I complained, I moaned, but I stayed out of the food because I knew there was nothing, any amount that I could eat that would help that. I had to live through the pain of it. And I tried everything, talked to everybody, tried everything. And finally, one person lovingly sat me down and said, this is a person at work, and said, Meg, you know you're not going to win this. You need to start looking at your exit strategy. And I didn't like hearing that, but at that time I knew it was true. And I had to face a lot of things at that time, and things that were right there hovering, but they weren't coherent enough for me because my heart couldn't handle the truth of that yet. So I ended up leaving, and I was on my own doing some freelance stuff or whatever, and worked really hard to finish my master's program at home because it was online, so it was awesome. So anyway, I decided to be a contractor. I have a love-hate relationship with corporations. I don't do the politics well, and the older I get, the less I do the politics well because I can't schmooze for schmooze sake. And there's times I'm too direct, and I don't mean direct in a mean way. It's just that if I think it's fluff and whatever, I just want to get to the chase. I just want to get to what it is we're doing. So being a contractor really worked well for me. In the meanwhile, while I was finishing school, I decided to write my paper on bullying in the workplace. And this is what I learned. That men and women are bullied equally. Or no, men and women bully equally. Women are more bullied. And this is what I wrote, you know, read in 2007, 2008. But the people who are bullied are people who are ethical. They could be whistleblowers. They're well-liked. They're very competent. They're very intelligent. You know, all these things. And I'm just like agog because I thought it was because I didn't do this job well and so on. And I even had friends in programs say, Meg, you really need to look at your part. Oh, I was ticked off. I did not deserve to be bullied. I did nothing to bring this on. So a couple years go by. I'm working my other gig and whatever, but doing some fourth and fifth steps around that. And I would say finally over, I would say probably in the last couple years that I could boldly, competently, confidently say, I do not like to project manage because to me, how I see it in my role, it's babysitting. To have to tell 40 and 50-year-olds, okay, you said you were going to get this done and you didn't. I'm not going to belittle them. I'm not going to hound them. I'm not going to do all these things because I think if you can't get it done, you'll let me know when I come up and say, how are things going and so on. When I taught 14-year-olds, I expected that behavior and I worked with that. But when I'm working with my peers, I don't do that. And I watched other people. I'm not saying all project managers do that. And that place I was at was a different environment. It did not match me. It was all about chaos, and my boss loved chaos. And I don't. I'm trying to work on balance. And so anyway, but this is my part in that whole thing that I was finally able to see. I made my boss and her boss and a colleague my higher power. How she viewed me was then who I really was. And the interesting thing is, I had said something to the wrong person, so it hastened my end date. A character defect of mine. Anyway, and paid a little consequence for that. But anyway, the day that I was given my walking papers and I was with the HR person and my boss. Now, you'd think my boss was this big, you know, 7-foot woman, you know, full beard, you know, wore a spiked collar and whatever. And she was probably this big around and she was about this tall. And anyway, she was sitting there, but she just said, well, I think this should be your last day. Don't you think? I mean, this is the first time she showed uncertainty. And the first time I said, you're the manager, make the call. I finally showed up. And I knew it was my last day. I didn't want to be there anymore. That was the whole thing. I was just hanging on to the sinking ship because somehow I was trying to save my own self-perception of what I thought others thought of me. So anyway, what I learned in all of that, and it's been a long, slow healing of really looking at myself and claiming my part. And the only way I could do that was through this program, was through all of you and hearing your stories. And the thing is, when I look at my life, yes, I had some really tough things in my life, but overall, I hear a lot of your stories, and I'm like, mine's like holding a little birthday candle compared to some of the bonfires that go on in this room. And that I'm in awe of all the stories. I mean, today was phenomenal. All the workshops I was in and hearing such raw honesty, raw truth. That's how we're going to get better, is to really lay it out there. What is going on? I can say and quote in a book and say, well, I know 12 and 12 says this and that, which is good to know. I'm not saying this is wrong. How am I applying this in my everyday life? If I turn my life and care over to a higher power, have I taken the time to learn who my higher power is? And then who is my higher power in my everyday life? Am I really taking time out to talk to who that is? Or am I looking to a boss? Or an income? Or a way of life? Or a wardrobe? Or the people I hang out with? Or my social media profile? No. Because when it all comes down to it, when I'm laying in a box or ready to be cooked, I'm going to be cremated, who cares? People aren't going to say, oh, that's Meg, you know, she had this, this, and she's done that. You know, who really cares? Who really cares? Was I kind and loving? Was I patient and tolerant? That's what I'm here to learn in this program, is to really strip down and be human in this program. So one of the things that, you know, I'm just going to talk about where my anchors are right now, because I've been abstinent since June 14th, 2004. And my food plan, like I said, has changed. Now I eat as a vegan. And when I work, I'm in between gigs right now. When I work for someone else, I eat 5 times a day because there's more activity and, you know, time frame and whatever. Now that I'm working from home and doing some things, I eat 3 times a day and that's it. And when I travel too. I don't want to stop in the middle of something and say, excuse me, chomp, 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 chomp. And, you know, and I don't need to, because I know I'm not going to starve to death between meals. I haven't yet. So I look that, you know, service was the thing to do. So I focused on, well, really, I focused on 3 things. I focused on the 12th step, because basically it says, after having worked all of the steps, we'll get this spiritual awakening. And then it's my responsibility to pass that along. And that doesn't mean I stand in a box and say, oh, listen to all the wise words of Meg. It means, am I kind and loving in the discount store? How am I to a clerk in a gas station? How am I when someone's in my face and having a hard day? How am I on the road when someone cuts me off and I'm late for something? You know, that is, how am I doing that? The next thing that I need to, is the action plan. And I just want to go over this. You know, action plan is basically, what are the things that I do on a daily basis to keep me in this program and to keep me engaged and to keep me working and being honest and true? And so for me, I would say 98% of the time I weigh and measure my food. You know, I had the meals here this weekend and I brought my own supplement of stuff. Because back in 2006, my cholesterol was at 230. And I thought, wow, that's weird. I've been eating clean for 2 years. So I decided to go to a dietitian, you know, with rolled eyes, because I know everything there is to know about food. I have read all the diets. I've tried them all. I know about calories and whatever. So I filled out a 6-page questionnaire, and there was a thing on there, you know, what are your triggers? You know, what things do you always, like, go to over and over again, you know, or in the past? And so, of course, mine was bread and sugar and, you know, any sugar. And then there was a thing on there, how much diet pop do you drink a day? And I was like, oh, I got to be honest. So I was mostly honest. I put 18 cans a day. I'm an addict, you guys. I'm critical level. I failed to put the other thing on there, and I'll tell you that. So she comes, and she's working very hard. She knows about OA, folks. That's what I love about her. She's not one of us, but she gets it. Anyway, she's looking at it, and she sees where I have 18 cans. And she goes, oh, is this accurate? Is this what you put on there? And I said, well, I said, I eat gum every day. And she's like, oh, well, okay. And I said, 18 packer. She goes, oh. She goes, that's your problem. Because I said, oh, I eat eggs every day. She goes, forget that. She goes, the artificial sweetener. She said, you're killing your liver. I didn't tell her about the 4 quarts of Crystal Light I was drinking, too. I'm an addict, guys. It's all about volume. So she said, that's it. And then, because of my ethnic heritage, I'm Irish, German, Bohemian. But because I have a lot of colon issues in my family, my mom had ulcerative colitis at 29, had her full large intestine removed. My dad had colon section surgery. My sister at that time did, and then later on my brother did. So there's just a little bit of that going on. Anyway, she said, if anything, please give that up. And then she said, I'd like you to really seriously look at the wheat. She said, you have trapped gas every day. She said, wheat's your problem. She said, with your family stuff and so on, she said, you're probably not digesting it, and that's probably why. And so she said, you know, and then she said, with the artificial sweetener, she said, I'm surprised you feel satiated after you eat. She said, artificial sweetener is sweeter than sugar, and it stimulates your appetite. So I was very mature, and I looked at her, and I said, well, don't expect me to start this tonight. And she looked at me and said, whatever, you know. And she was probably like, oh, my God, back. And so it took me a couple weeks, but, you know, I did, because then I had to weigh and measure my food. Something, of course, you know, I've heard people in here say, I was never going to do that. I'm above that. So anyway, started with my food plan that she gave me, and I'll tell you what, after a week of giving up wheat, I did not have trapped gas for a consistent basis for the first time in my life. I was a colicky baby, I learned, when I was a kid. I hadn't even consumed milk in a long time because it just didn't agree with me. So I was still doing some dairy and so on. So, all right, that's my modified food plan. I was eating six times a day. See, isn't that nice? That's six versus three. Doesn't that sound nice? And so anyway, did that. And then a couple years later, I tripped down my stairs and bruised my feet really badly. And I was walking anywhere from like 12 to 20 miles a week, you know, as part of my physical fitness. And I couldn't. I mean, I walked like Frankenstein for about 9 months. I had to get different shoes. And so I cut out my snack before bedtime because I knew I wasn't expending that kind of energy. And so I made some adjustments with my sponsor and all that stuff. So as time went on, I'm feeling healthy. Oh, so my cholesterol was at 230 a year later. Okay, here's the mind of an addict. Well, if my cholesterol doesn't significantly go down, I'm going back to my diet drink. It went from 230 to 162. That was even bigger. I didn't even have a number in my head, but I knew that that was significant. So I stayed awake. So I have been off of gum, artificial sweeteners, and wheat since 2006. So my life has gotten better. So then I was eating, you know, dairy and things like that. And I eat 8 cups of vegetables a day. I eat 12 ounces of starch vegetable a day. And I was eating, you know, my meat and, you know, or dairy, you know, as protein and so on. And I was still really constipated. And I thought, something's really, really wrong. And then I had my second colonoscopy and I had polyps. And to me, that was like alarm, because I didn't the first time. I thought, I'm eating healthy. Dairy went. And I always kind of wanted to give up meat, because some meat, you know, you get, unless it's organic and all that stuff, was just starting to seem kind of rubbery to me. And then there was also some cuts of meat that were like, this tastes like more. And so, and I also have some very healthy foods like cherries and grapes. Do not have sleepovers at my house. You know, I'll eat them at a function like this, if that's part of a fruit medley or whatever, but no, they just don't get to come over. And so anyway, I decided to give up meat and all animal grain. And I'll tell you what, my system worked beautifully. And so I've been eating this way for 4 years. And what has surprised me the most is not that I feel better and feel great, is the very sometimes hostile actions I get from people. What? You don't eat meat? What do you do for protein? And it's not like I'm standing here at 50 pounds emaciated and going, oh, yeah. I'm a good, sturdy woman. And I said, I eat beans and lentils. That's what I swap. You know, I sometimes do rice. That doesn't hold me very well. Don't bother. I'll eat oatmeal in the morning. I even eat it dry. I am a lazy food preparer. I would rather eat raw. I'd rather eat cold. I mean, I ate my fish cold back in the day, because it's like, if you're even putting it in the microwave, seriously, step number one, open the door. Step number two, put it in the plate. Step number three, push the buttons. I'm serious. Whereas my dad was a phenomenal cook, I took after my mom. I got her genes. She just wasn't interested. So, but I really love the food I eat, and I really do well with the food I eat. And I decided after a couple years, too, talking with a friend of mine in program, in fact, my former sponsor, now we're just friends, and, you know, she just said to me, Meg, you know, you're getting kind of soft, and you're getting old. And I said, yeah, I know, because she's been working out. And I said, yeah, I'll think about it. She said, you know what, you've been thinking about this for 2 years. So she said, either shut up or do something about it. So I said, all right, what's your person's name? So I go to this woman, and she's got some guns on her. I mean, they're awesome. But I'm not striving to be her. I'm not the Meg of, you know, 30 years old. I'm the Meg of 58. You know, it's kind of like, all right, I work 2 days, I get a day off. See, I had yesterday and today off because I modified a bit for travel. But tomorrow I'll be in the little weight room, you know, doing my weights and all that. But I'll tell you, I feel stronger. And part of what is driving me with this now is that I am getting older. And if I were to fall or really hurt myself, how quickly will I recover? You know, I was a caregiver of my aunt. She became very frail and started falling. And I thought, she'll snap. She's like a little bird. And I thought, you know, I mean, I've got quite a few pounds to go there and whatever, and I'm not planning on going there, but just in general, what is my health like should something happen? So that's what drives me. And I really look at also the second tradition of the fact that we're all equal in this fellowship. No matter how we practice this program, there's a big how element in the Twin Cities. And I had a prejudice about that back in the day. And because, you know, all those Nazis, you know, about their food, you know, they weigh and measure and they make 57 phone calls every day and, you know, all this stuff. And finally a friend, a region friend, said, hey, let's go to a HOW meeting. This was at a Minnesota State Convention. And I'm like, all right. She goes, yeah. She goes, let's let them know we're going to infiltrate. Because we're the traditionals. Oh, it was the most enlightening meeting. There's so much physical recovery there. There was so much happiness and positivity and all of that. And they had a two-hour meeting. My meeting's an hour and a half. We do like business for half an hour, talk, share, you're done. And so, anyway, that was the beginning of, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And at that point, I started looking at doing a little more service. I was an intergroup rep, and my higher power in January of 2010, it was kind of like a hand. You know, that gentle hand that just kind of pushes you. It's like you don't even look back. You just know. And said, you're going to go to the intergroup meeting today because they were making doing elections, and you're going to raise your hand, and you're going to say you're going to be treasurer. I said, oh, okay. So I went there, and they asked for elections right away. And, of course, I raised my hand and said, I'm Megan. I would like to put my name in for treasurer. And the person who was conducting this, she had been the vice chair, started laughing. And I was like, oh, God, is that really wrong? And she goes, oh, my God, I've been coming here for years. We've never had anyone volunteer to be treasurer. Usually we have to beg people. So needless to say, I got elected. And then the next 2 years, I was chair. And at that point, I started joining region. I became a region rep. And then my world exploded in beautiful technicolor. I met people. I met Cindy, I met Connie, I met Elizabeth, I met Pat. I mean, you know, just by coming around and by the fact that I've done all this, that's why I'm here. People know about me. And it's not like, oh, you know, people know about me. It's that I am present. And so then I became a world delegate. And then it was like, oh my gosh, here's so-and-so from Louisiana. They have the same food problem as I do. Oh, there's so-and-so from New Zealand. Oh, there's so-and-so from Poland. Oh my gosh. One of the coolest things still is that every day they have two different people say the Serenity Prayer in their native tongue. It is beautiful. It is so beautiful. And so it's like these are the things I would want for you is to step forward and be a region rep. Expand your community. We are a global community now. We can talk on the phone. We can Skype. We can email. And then you go to World. And then you get to participate in when you vote on making for today. Or a pamphlet. Or how many of you know about the latest 12-step, 12 traditions workbook? Our study. So we have all those things where you participate in because everything's written by us. For us. To share. And so we get to hear other people's stories. We get to work on committees where we get to try things and, you know, and the other thing I got out of that, every character defect that you have gets a little challenged. Because there's going to be someone where you're like, ooh, got to practice at principles before personalities. And what's the only way to really work this program is to work this program. And so that's the thing that I really got out of this. And so then I became, well, in fact, I ran for treasurer of Region 4, and I didn't get it. And I thought there was a chance, and my ego, you know, I felt very sad, and I was talking to another rep that, you know, we were rooming with or whatever, and I was very sad about it and stuff. And yet I knew that I was meant to be chair of our intergroup because I just really wanted to be a part of service. And, you know, but there was still that old, you know, popularity contest-y thing, you know, that goes on and so on. And the thing is, at that time, Cindy was chair, and she came up to me and she said, Meg, and I think that was all the warm hand I needed to say, okay, stay with us. She said, how would you like to be chair of the Ways and Means Committee? And I said, sure, because I'm of old school. Someone asks you to do something in service, you say, sure. Because your higher power will help you out. And you know what? So people in this room. There's always going to be someone who knows something and they'll tell you and whatever. Sometimes whether you want them to or not. So anyway, I did that and then ended up becoming chair of Region 4 for 4 years. And I'll tell you, that's when I really started learning a deeper level of humility. And because I worked this program and because I had to see myself in more of my base self, I really started seeing more of the joys around me and not getting so freaked out and worked up. I was always a person that had to have plan B and then maybe plan C. And then sometimes, well, we better have a plan D over here in case plan C didn't quite work out, plan B fizzled out, and then if this and that. I mean, I spent lots of mental energy, mental real estate on all this stuff. And meanwhile, my dad, I know, is in another program, but this is, you know, about recovery here, got sober. And at 61. So he taught me, you're never too old to get it. You're never too old to step in these rooms. You're never too old to learn to do something differently. You're never too old to be vulnerable. And so I watched him. In those early days, I was tough on him because it was tough growing up. And that was my issue. So working on all of that, working my steps, you know, practicing these principles in all of my years, that means with my dad. That means with my siblings. There's a lot of recovery in my family. My dad's 87. I was able to buy his 25-year medallion a couple years ago. He's still doing it. And my sister was down there in January, and for the first time, I mean, he's been going to his program, he shared his story. Because one of his younger, kind of sponsees kind of things said, hey, Jim, you haven't shared your story. You're an old timer. Get up there. So he did. And my sister was there to hear it. And how beautiful that was. And the fact that I am sober, abstinent, that I could appreciate his growth and really see him as just another fellow in recovery. Here's another gifts of the program. Last February, all five of us kids were home. An aunt had died. We were going to the wake and saw, and my dad said, okay. And here's the thing. I'm so much like my dad. It kind of frightens me. I'm surprised I wasn't named after him, Junior. Anyway, he's looking at his watch, and he's like, okay, everybody done now? We're like, yeah, dad, watch. Well, I want us all in the living room. I want to talk to you about how my drinking is affecting your life. 87 years old. I made my amends to my dad. I did on his 80th birthday, where I sat in a car and I read the letter to him because it was raining outside and I wanted him out of the house because my brother was there at the time. I've done living amends. I've done lots of amends. And then there's times I just would rather, you know, slice my own throat because it's like, oh, Meg, you really had to say that yet again. So we all sat around his living room and he read a letter one sister had written a couple months after he had gotten sober. My mom and he got sober at the same time. My mom died 6 months later. She died sober. And then he would call on each of us. And he called on her. She's number four. Then he called on number two and then three. And then went to number five and read his letter that he had written. My dad had asked us back then to write how his drinking affected our lives. And he read that letter. And then my brother talked and shared it. He said, I want you to hold nothing back. And then he read mine. And then I shared. And I shared some of the pains that I struggle with. And what's cool, when I think about the things that we're talking about today, and one is intimacy and sexuality. And I said, I've never been able to have a healthy relationship with a man in the sense that I don't pick healthy men. And I said, I struggle with that. But for the first time, really to say that, I didn't see it as his fault. It was just a side effect, a symptom. And then I talked about some other things that I felt I was never good enough and how I struggled with that. But this is what I was doing. But what I'm saying is, because I'm abstinent and because I'm working a rigorous program, I was not able to torpedo him. It was like I could share my pain. And then I said, because I needed to say this in front of my siblings, being the oldest and all-powerful and sometimes a little too, and I said, I know that there's times I make you pay for what Mom did and said, and I'm sorry. And I need to say this in front of everyone because they do look at me. Because I was a surrogate parent for many years. And I said, and I'm sorry. And this is what I'm doing to change my ways. And I said, I'm deeply touched and aware of this miracle that you are being vulnerable to us and hearing what we have to say. And we laughed, we talked, we shared. This was 2 hours. I mean, it wasn't like a whole weekend where we had to call in mediators. But we were able to share. And I really feel a shift with him. And it's really at a good time because I was there last month. And for the first time, his age has caught up with him. And we're looking at saying, Dad, maybe it's time to move into a one-level apartment. And I can be of service to him and not be angry and resentful and wish he was different. And if I can extend that to him, maybe I can extend that to other people in this program. In that I'm not perfect and I don't need to be. Because one of the big things that I've learned in this program is I'm not perfect. You all know that. But for me to say it with clarity and to say it unapologetically and to say I'm flawed, it's okay, because we all are. And the bottom line is, who cares? Are we doing and being the best whoever we are that we can be? And it goes into working these steps and reading our readings and writing and picking up that phone. And one core thing I work on is that I really believe you We are 100% responsible for our abstinence. 100%. I think of how many people I've sponsored over the years while I went to a graduation party, and they didn't have what was on my food plan. And I said, the hostess or host is not in charge of your food plan. You are. What's your backup plan? That's an action plan. That is a healthy backup plan. Not having 42 jobs lined up. Not having all these smart comebacks lined up to attack the next person who might say something sarcastic or something I take personally or whatever. But it's about, what am I willing to do to stay alive? Because I today, the other day I weighed, I'm 139. And I really believe if I were to step out and eat sugar right now, in less than 6 weeks, I'd be 300 pounds. And that's what I tell myself. Because I already know what it's like. I remember when I stepped out, into food, I ate a Snickers. You know what my first thought was? God, these are awful. That was it. It's off to the races. So I already know. And for the last almost 13 years, my disease is still working. Still working. And weights. It does drive by thoughts. It kind of says, Meg, hey, look over here. And then I'll say sometimes to people, I'll just say, you know what, I'm going to leave because my eyes are a little too interested in what you're eating. And I do all those kinds of things. I don't watch food channels. I don't look at recipes. I don't, oh, because to me that's crack. It's just crack. And I, why? What, how, is it benefiting my life? When I was at World last year, we were talking about, again, you know, you ever look in the mirror? Okay, I'm 58. I've got a few wrinkles, and you know, gravity does its thing, and then you carry an extra, you know, 20 pounds on you for how many years? You're going to have a little extra. So you look in the mirror, and, well, if I start sucking in, and, you know, and if I did this, and, you know, then maybe, what? I'm going to make more money and have a better job and have men fawning all over me. I mean, what? And it's like, no, I don't want to be a dork. I want to be appreciated and respected for who I am because I'm a respectable person. And this woman said, yeah, yeah, I do that too. And she goes, you know, one night after doing that for 15 minutes, she said, I thought, oh my God, I could have made an outreach call during that 15 minutes. So I think about that now. And I think, what am I doing differently to keep this program alive and well? Back to when I thought 1 week meeting was too much. My first year as intergroup chair, higher power tapped me on the shoulder. You know, it's kind of like, I think I need to get kind of like a, you know, a barrier. You know, like those circle bubbles or something, you know, barbed wire or whatever. But it's like, hey, mate, I'd like you to visit all those intergroup meetings. I said, you got to be kidding me. There's 70. HB says, yeah, I know. Well, I'm not going to have the time, and you realize how much gas and how much, you know, driving that is? Yeah. Well, and, you know, this, that, and the other thing, and it's like, Meg, got you covered. I went to those 70 meetings. Well, really 69, because they're already gone to one. I didn't have to revisit that one in 7 months. Because part of me, I'm like, go, all right, ooh, dun, dun. You know, we're going for it. But I got to go as a newcomer 69 times. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience. I even had people say to me, what are you, the OA police? No. I did take a few stats just because I'm always interested. And, you know, 12% men, few, very, very, very few people of color, which is sad for me in the Twin Cities area. So it's kind of like, what are, you know, we doing to get the message out there? Because this disease doesn't care what socioeconomic culture we come from. You know, we love our food, we go for it. We're Westerners. You know, I see people come from other countries, and they are healthy body weights, and they're mowing down the sugar like those. There's no tomorrow. And I just say, please don't. Please don't. Stay healthy. Please. And Anyway, went to all those meetings, and it was, like I said, one of the most humbling, beautiful experiences. And now that I'm taking time off from bigger service right now, I'm working on my meeting and, you know, giving talks now and then and so on and doing whatever little things that I can along the way, I want to start visiting the meetings again because it was so fun, especially the outliers of the Twin Cities. And so when I tracked, you know, how many miles I put in over 6,000 miles doing that. I didn't track hours, but the farthest meeting away was 3 hours one way. So I left work at 3:30 that day, got there at 6:30, meeting started at 7 to 8:30, hopped back in my car, drove home. Hey, books on tape, you know, it's awesome. So it was wonderful. So when I look at this program and I look at what am I doing to live this program and be an example, and it doesn't mean, oh, hey, look at me. It means, how do I greet my day in the morning? I greet my day, I journal, and then I meditate. And when I was having difficulty with meditating because I wanted to, and I thought, well, I can't do it right, so why not? I just won't do it. You know, all or nothing, you know, good act thinking. I was at World, and I saw this woman. She was from the Bronx. She scared me. And somehow, yes, which is good. But I just knew she needed it. I wanted her to be my spirit sponsor. So I had told my roommate at the time I was going to do it, but I was scared. What? Like she was going to, what, take a chunk out of my neck as a response to say, no, I don't want to do this, and so on. And she was also recovering from a physical disease. She was in remission. And I thought, well, if I see her, whatever. Well, there's a thing called the boutique at World, and it's a room where they have all their ways and means. So they have things from all the regions, and you could buy stuff and whatever. And I was there on Saturday night at 4 o'clock. So then there would be banquet, and everybody flies out on Sunday. So it was like the last night. So I'm in the room, and she comes in the room. There's just the two of us. I chickened out. I'm like, Meg, you can do it. You can do it. Oh, no. And I left. So we're sitting at the table with my roommate. She's like, how did it go? And I said, I'm a waste. I said, I'm the biggest wimp I know to man. And I said, I blew my chance. I just a failure. I mean, my mind started going right there. And she goes, oh, I see your last chance walking by right now. So I got up, and I'm like, you know, walking with her to the loo. And I'm like, hi. You know, my name's Megan. I'm from Minneapolis. And, you know, and I said, and she stopped, and I just explained whatever, and I said, I know you're busy and all this. You know, the usual stuff. I know you're busy. Please say no, because I'm giving you all the reasons why you can say no. Instead, I really want you to say yes. But I said, I would just really like to know if you'd be my spirit sponsor, because I knew she meditated. She got down on her knees every night and so on. And I said, you only have to talk to me once a month. I'm very low maintenance, and I will do everything that you tell me. She said, okay, well, I got to go in for one more treatment, contact me in 3 weeks, and whatever. And, of course, like I said, she scared me enough that if she would have said, stand on your hands, try to clap your feet together, and then call me at 3:01 in the morning, I would have done just that. So 3 weeks come, I email her, nothing, and I'm like, oh, what do I do? And it's like, oh, for God's sakes, put your big girl pants on and email her again. So I did. She wrote back, she said, oh, thank you, I'm so glad, you know, I had a rough go this time, whatever. And she goes, okay, call me tomorrow, and such and such. So I called her, and then she said, okay, I want you to sit and just be quiet for 3 minutes and do your gig. I said, okay, I can do that. And then she said, all right, and well, when we talk tomorrow at the same time. And I'm thinking, tomorrow? I said, once a month, you know. I didn't say this to her, of course, there's no way. So that's what I did. I called her. And then I started building more of a quiet spiritual practice for me. And then she's like, you know, read something from the 12 and 12 or whatever. And, you know, so I mean, tying in program, but really for me, it was just sitting down and being quiet instead of always move, 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 think, because that's what I do. That's my go-to place. So I did that. And the one lesson I learned from her, because I know I've got to work on wrapping it up, that I do on a regular basis, not every day, but anyway, So I was telling her, you know, I said, gee, I've noticed lately that my resentments are disappearing and they're lessening or whatever. She says, oh, like what? And I said one, and she goes, okay. She said, have you ever heard of the resentment letter? I said, no. And she goes, well, I want you to write a letter. And I want you to write everything you want for that person. I said, oh, yeah, that's a resentment prayer. She says, yeah, I know, but you're going to write this. And you're going to write everything you want for them, and you're going to do it for 2 weeks, every day in a row. If you missed a day, start over. So I did it, and, you know, did it good. And I thought, well, I'll try another one. So I told her, I'm fine. And I was doing my third one, because she's like, oh, I think you have one more person. It was an old boss. And not the one boss, but yeah, I did her. No problem. This boss is okay. And anyway, missed a day and started over, and then missed a day and started over, and then I'd said something to her, or she asked me or whatever, and I said, well, I missed a day, and she goes, well, I hope you started over. See, part of me still hoping that she'd be like, that's okay. You can just pick up where you left off. I'm like, oh, yeah, I did. Mm-hmm. So, fourth round, I'm at Minnesota State Convention with my roommate, yakking and talking and whatever. Saturday night, laying down, getting ready to go to bed, my eyes flip open. I missed the day before. The day before would have been day 13. So I thought, well, I'll start over tomorrow. It's late, the lights are out, whatever. So when I talked to her on Monday, I told her, and she said, oh, that's good diet mentality. I'll start tomorrow. I'll start on Monday. I did not miss a day in that next 14 days again. She unfortunately has died. I was blessed to have time with her when she was here. It was a couple years later, and I was doing a retreat, and I was doing a resentment letter for someone, and I laid in bed, and I realized it would have been day 5, and I'd missed day 4. And my first thought was, I knew she was looking for my mom. I got up, flipped on that light, started on day 1, right then and there. And so those are the precious gems I've learned in this program. That was not super fun or whatever, but very helpful. Because when I find myself resenting, which we cannot do in this program, gets us into world hurt, and it really doesn't do anybody any good. And we really don't want to wish harm on other people. We really don't. And so I just really work my program as if my life depended on it, because it does. I have a life now. I am between gigs. My big program was canceled. I'm unemployed right now. In the past, I'd be so wigged out, I would take anything. I would take shoveling debris in a gutter, like I said, just to do anything. But at this point, it's like I have money in the bank, because as a contractor, I plan for those things. Because I've been abstinent, I've learned how to plan, manage my money better, etc. And also, I'm starting a business. So what I'm doing is really focusing my energy on that. In case my HP says, you know, maybe now's the time. Boom, you're ready. Even though I'm saying, well, I'm not quite ready because I have to have this in alignment and whatever else. And it's like, you know, really? Who runs the show? It's not me. Even though there's many times I think I do or try to. So what I'll talk more about tomorrow, but really is the part of this program, OA is a wonderful life when we get out of our own way and let it unfold and hear what our higher power asks us to do and what to be for that day, and to be present and to work this program. And with that, I pass.